There was a time when nearly every American knew what Saigon was because we heard the name every day. It was the capital of South Vietnam and so the seat of our allies in the war in Vietnam. The city fell in 1975, ending the war, and the communist regime renamed the place Ho Chi Minh City. This hour, we visit with a guest whose family escaped Saigon just before it fell. Phuc Tran grew up in Pennsylvania, navigating a course between the world his family knew and the one he was native to. He tells the story in his memoir, Saigon. Phuc Tran teaches Latin and applies tattoos in Portland. That's the other Portland in Maine. He appeared on an NPR TED Radio Hour with his TED Talks from 2012 called Grammar, Identity, and the Dark Side of the Subjunctive. Phuc Tran, good to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for having me. It's a delight.
Just the table of contents made me smile. Each chapter is a book title. What did you do here?
In the simplest terms, I tried to tell my story through the lens of great classic works of literature that really helped me make sense of my story as a refugee and, you know, as a kid of the 80s growing up in a town that didn't seem to have a space for me or didn't have a space for me that I fit into. So many of those chapter books like Crime and Punishment or Madame Bovary or The Metamorphosis helped shed some light onto my own experience and helped me make sense of things.
Well, you've certainly come up with your own writing after studying the works of great writers. There's a great line early in the book about Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where you grew up. Carlisle's population offered all the rainbows of Caucasia, which sort of follows along. You stuck out a bit there, it sounds like.
For sure. There were four relocation camps in the United States in 1975. There was one in California, one in Pennsylvania, and then there was two others, one in Arkansas and one in Florida. And so we were at Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania until some very nice Lutherans decided to sponsor our family of 12 from that relocation camp. You know, what's interesting, you know, as I sort of learned about that period of our own history, was that the federal government actually had a specific program that was designed to not create ethnic enclaves. So the Vietnamese people who came here as part of that diaspora were specifically discouraged from living and settling in communities with each other. So we were part of that grand experiment. I think their thinking was that it would expedite and accelerate our assimilation, right? And it did. I think much to my own and my parents' discomfort, you know, I think at some point you're like, wait, I don't look like everyone else, you know, and yet I feel like I should have a seat at the table and have a voice, you know, in this conversation. And, you know, what does that mean?
The not looking like everyone else was an issue. You were the only Asian kid in your school through eighth grade, you report. How much were you bullied?
A fair amount. And it's hard to say what's normal. You know, I can only speak from my own experience. I think it's in elementary school, sort of like playground taunts. And then I think as we got older, I think there's that kind of that, you know, for lack of a better term, I think like that toxic masculinity that shows up. And then all of a sudden it turns into sort of like real fistfights. And I can't say scientifically if I was bullied more or less than other kids, because, you know, I think it's certainly something that kids don't take, you know, share at the lunch table about, you know, comparing notes about who's getting shoved into lockers more than other kids. But I certainly had my fair share, you know, but thankfully I found a great group of, sort of punk rock skateboarders who I think we all sort of shared a common goal of, you know, just skateboarding and listening to punk rock music. And they were really my lifeline, you know.
Did the interest in being a good student come before that, though? I mean, what you call Operation Sound Smart in the book?
I think that happened. You mean prior? You know, I think prior to high school, it seemed like school is relatively easy for me. I have to be honest; I didn't put a whole lot of effort into it. And then once I got to high school, my parents, I think, because they felt beleaguered, and also they wanted to. They didn't really know how to raise American teenagers. And so they just had this arrangement with me where they said, you know, if you stay on the honor roll, you can pretty much do whatever you want, you know. And you know, now as a parent, I'm like, wow, that's so like hands off, you know, like they were the opposite of like snowplow and helicopter parents. But I think it was an incredible amount of freedom for me and my brother, and also sort of allowing us to own that responsibility of, you know, doing well academically. But I think Operation Sound Smart, as I call it in the book, was really about trying to gain some kind of social cachet, you know, and I realized at some point that there was a small segment of my student body that really respected kids who sounded smart. And I want to say that it is called Operation Sound Smart because I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I would read Faulkner and, you know, Proust or Flaubert, and I would just sort of name drop these authors, you know, in class, you know, in an effort to be like, hey, look at me, I read books.
So talk about finding Clifton Fadiman's book in the library, because this seems like a pivotal moment for you.
Yeah, it was so strange, and I didn't know anything about him. So in my town, I worked at the library, the Bosler Library in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and they were having this huge discard sale, and so it was my job to sort of lug all these hundreds of boxes up from the basement. You know, and like any good teenager, I procrastinated and spent as much time doing the actual job as possible. So I would just paw through these books. I would flip them open and just like look through all these discarded books. And I saw this book called The Lifetime Reading Plan by Clifton Fadiman. And I had no idea who he was. I didn't know what it was about. I just flipped it open and it said, you know, the 107 books that any well-cultured and well-read American should read. And I thought, wow, like this, you know, up to that point, I was just reading whatever I could get my hands on or things that seemed interesting, you know, and literally judging books by their cover. And then I got this book and it said, you know, according to Clifton Fadiman, these are the 100 some books that you should read. And it was 50 cents. I had 50 cents to spend for a lifetime of reading.
It was worth it. Okay. We learned a lot more about Fuchtron's book or his life as his memoir goes on. And it is called Cy Gone, a misfit's memoir of great books, punk rock, and the fight to fit in. We'll come back and talk more with Fuchtron, and you can join us by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. One of the things I'm struck by, Fuch, early in the book is Operation Sound Smart, you know, trying to make sure that you knew things and got good grades and were well-read. Talked about the other operation for the outside, Operation Look Punk. You already talked about punk rockers and skateboarders. But so it sounds like this desire to mold yourself while simultaneously loathing yourself.
Yeah, I think it's complicated, right? I think, for me, I think it's really hard to unpack, you know, how much of that is just sort of teen angst. Because I think, you know, having been a high school teacher for two decades now, I think I see that even in, you know, kids who are in the majority, right? Like, I think it's just a mode where teenagers are, you know, moving, going through their own metamorphosis, right? From, you know, pupa to chrysalis. And I don't know, for me, I think, Jeffrey, it's hard to unpack how much of that was, you know, internalized, you know, racism, you know, coming from an abusive family, or, you know, just being, you know, a lonely kid. If you have any insights on that, I'd love to hear what you think. And I think trying to tease those things apart, you know, is not fruitful for me. I think like that compartmentalization, I think ends up feeling forced. And I think I think one of the things that I did in the book or tried to do in the book is to sort of take all the distinct Venn diagrams of who I am and where I came from and, you know, present them as they are in a messy way. You know, I think about, you know, Walt Whitman's song of Myself, and when he says, you know, do I contradict myself? You know, so then I contradict myself. I contain multitudes. And I take that to heart. I think it's an incredible credo, you know, for us as human beings to be messy and to present ourselves in all of our sort of, you know, seeming paradoxes.
We're not consistent in how we present ourselves to ourselves, come to think of it.
Yeah.
So this is all part of the introduction we're talking about here, which you call the prologue, the picture of Dorian Gray. Picture, you know, this is, of course, the famous Oscar Wilde novel about the portrait in the attic that grew old and horrible while the person who it was taken of or painted of stayed young and smooth-looking to the world. So what was in your attic in your mind?
Yeah, I think how I felt about myself and how... even how, and specifically, you know, when I use that books to talk about how I felt about this new Vietnamese kid who showed up my junior year of high school. And I think it's, and I never knew that this was a specific feeling until I sort of started unpacking this and then reading about it. I was reading about this specifically with, this is a phenomenon that happens between women in power, and that also feels really interesting to me, that sometimes, you know, when there's one woman in power in the boardroom and then another woman shows up, instead of feeling a kinship or an alliance with them, they suddenly feel threatened by them, because I think there's like this power structure that says, you know, you can be the one as long as you play ball with us, and then all of a sudden another person shows up and you feel threatened by that. And so I felt a lot of, you know, loathing and, you know, animosity towards this, you know, this poor kid who just literally showed up in our high school. I was never actively hostile towards him, but I could name that I felt something, there was something about him that was provocative and really, made me cringe. And I think part of that prologue is for me to unpack, you know, even 30 years later, what I was feeling and why I felt that way.
Well, you pick great little moments that tell larger stories in the book. And so for example, I mean, why as a child were you asking your father what your name is?
Yeah, I mean, that's so, you know, and I didn't even realize how strange it was until I started writing it. It's my earliest memory as a kid. I'm about 4 years old. And, you know, one is that, you know, Vietnamese just doesn't sound like English. And also in Vietnamese, there's a very complicated system of pronouns that are used. My parents actually almost rarely used my name. They would use other, you know, nicknames or pronouns. And so, you know, when, as I was learning English and I was going to a playground, you know, kids would say, you know, what's your name? And I had no idea, you know, and I only knew the Vietnamese pronunciation of it, you know, which is phuc. And so my earliest memory is being in our apartment and asking my dad what my name was in English, you know, sort of registering that, you know, I had this internal, you know, indoor life that was Vietnamese. And then there was this external experience, which was American, right? Yeah.
The book is called Saigon, A Misfit's Memoir of Great Books, Punk Rock, and the Fight to Fit In. Phuc Tran, its author, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The story of your family's escape from Saigon, it was a fairly narrow one. I mean, and describe for folks just how narrow this was.
Sure. So my grandparents, maternal grandparents, worked for the U.S. Embassy. And so in April of 1975, when the U.S. government was closing down the embassy and pulling out all of its workers, the government actually made a call. You know, Gerald Ford, right, made this executive call to evacuate all Vietnamese, South Vietnamese collaborators as well. Which I think, you know, in the grand historical scheme of things, seems so unlikely. It was an incredibly unpopular decision by him and his administration. But he also recognized the sort of the moral imperative, right, that if he had just left behind, you know, these hundreds of thousands or, you know, 100,000 people who were working for the U.S. government, they would have been summarily executed. So my grandparents were beneficiaries of that executive order. And so we had our papers. We got in line to get on a bus that would take us to an airfield. And when we got on the bus, I started crying so much so that my grandmother, I think, just felt, you know, embarrassed or annoyed. I don't know why. I mean, who doesn't love being in small confines with a screaming baby? So we got off. My grandmother just ordered the entire family to get off the bus to wait for the next bus to leave. And so as the bus that we were supposed to be on pulled away, it was struck by rocket fire and then exploded and everyone on board died. So we got on the next bus, you know, crossed our fingers, hoped that it wouldn't blow up, and it didn't. And so we sort of hop skipped across the Pacific, and then ended up in Pennsylvania.
Wow, that's almost a supernatural tale of close shave.
It does, yeah. It feels very strange. Yeah.
The first chapter of the book is called The Plague, named, of course, for the Albert Camus book. You make a comparison with Dr. Ryu in The Plague, who had to come to grips with the things he could control and not. What were the kinds of things your parents thought about in terms of what they could control?
I mean, it is also an exploration of sort of what is faith and what is belief, right? And the things that you choose to have faith in. And my parents, I think, you know, there were so many things out of their control, but really the only thing that they could do was work. And they worked incredibly hard. You know, my father was a lawyer in Vietnam. And when he came to the United States, he had to relearn English and then, or not relearn, he had to learn English, decided not to relearn law. And he just went to work in a tire factory. And my mother, who was a homemaker, initially got a job at an apple orchard peeling apples. And, and amazingly, 10 years later, they were able to, you know, save enough money to, you know, buy a home. And I mean, it's pretty incredible, the opportunities that they've had. The sacrifices that they've made.
Indeed. Phuc Tran, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His family left Vietnam just before Saigon fell in 1975. His memoir of growing up in America is called Saigon, a misfit's memoir of great books, punk rock, and the fight to fit in. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions, comments, welcome at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So were you even 1 year old yet when the family left?
I was a year and a half, mm-hmm. So just around, yep. So mm-hmm. My earliest memory is of being in the United States. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I don't remember the escape at all.
Yeah. So why did you choose Crime and Punishment for the title of chapter two?
just in case if people weren't interested in my book, they might want to read about Dostoevsky. there was a lot of violence in my family, and it was really common. Some of it was low level violence, spanking and hitting kids on the rear end, and then some of it was pretty extreme. I think what I would categorize now as beatings, and I was really struck, not pun not intended, when I first read Crime and Punishment by how there's this atmosphere of violence that just suffuses the book. And it was the first time I remember reading it as a senior, I think, in high school, and a light bulb really going on in my mind and thinking, what is the thing that is infecting this whole book and Raskolnikov's story, right? And it's sort of this violence, this fear of violence, the potential of violence around, every corner. And that's when it really resonated with my own story, unlikely or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it wasn't, your father delivered most of the beatings, as you point out, but your mother let you have mm-hmm. it at one point for stealing your brother's sippy cup. And this is sort of an amazing story of like, oh my God, I can't believe I just did that.
Yeah. My mother, I was a typical older brother and just sort of, harassing and annoying my younger brother. And I stole my brother's drink, and my mother, just in exasperation, rolled up a magazine and just, clobbered me in the face. But, rolled up magazines end up feeling a lot like a piece of wood. And so it cut my the side of my face. But then my mother, really turned around and apologized, and she never struck me again. I mean, it left a very large scar on the side of my eye for a long time. But it was pretty incredible. And, in the book, I recount that as the only time that anyone in my family has ever apologized for, striking me out of turn.
A lot of violence, and you ended up punching a kid on the playground who called you names and things like that. But the principal at the school, too, delivered some corporal punishment?
Yeah, and I think that's really, surprising to me that I don't, in the 70s and the 80s, I guess, it was pretty common. I was talking to someone else about this in an early draft, and they were so appalled that the principal had a paddle, like a oar, basically, like a smallish oar, that he would use to hit kids across the rear end. And someone told me that they thought that was that I must have been mistaken. And I did some research, and I unofficially, but it seems like corporal punishment was very common in the 70s and the 80s, and now it's actually less so. I mean, it still is upheld in some states. I think maybe like 17 states, it's still legal for elementary school administrators to corporally punish children, which, you know, now just sounds barbaric, or at least I hope it sounds barbaric to some people. It doesn't make sense that, you know, the youngest, you know, and most sort of least developed members of our society should be beaten. It's pretty common, I guess.
Were you surprised,
Jeffrey, at that?
Well, I was, because I do remember teachers, I'm a little older than you, but teachers in third grade in particular slapping kids' wrists and things like that, but I don't remember any paddling. And I think by the time I'd gotten to high school, the whole concept of corporal punishment in schools was pretty much passe. When you were just when you just got to the United States. Even then it seemed like a remote past.
Yeah. I mean, my wife and I compared notes. We both definitely remembered, and she grew up here in Maine, but we both remembered the principal having, a paddle or, some sort of, corporal punishment as a deterrent, as it were, for kids, young kids.
Yeah, I have a vague memory of some being hung there. Maybe that was just as a, like, you could get this if you don't, behave. So more of a threat than anything else. But it wasn't a threat at home. And you report in the book that that your teacher actually visited with your parents after a particularly bad beating from your father. What happened after that?
She did, yeah. So she, and I think about how that would have, sort of played out now. So there was one beating where, my dad beat me so badly that I wasn't able to sit down in class. And I got in trouble for that because my teacher thought I was fidgeting. And then I finally told her what was happening. And so she called my parents and came and visited our home. And I actually wasn't privy to the actual conversation. I was asked to leave the room. But afterwards, after she left our house, I asked my parents why she visited. And my father just said, she told him that they couldn't, in the United States, there was a different, sort of expectation for how parents disciplined their children. And that, maybe there was a cultural disconnect and that my father shouldn't beat me as much as he is, or at all, I guess. I mean, because after that, the spankings and the beatings really stopped. But I think now it's, with like mandated reporting and teachers, I mean, she could have very well just called, DHHS or, Health and Human Services. And then, who knows what would have happened. But, I think it was an incredible intervention for her. And I mean, given that, this probably was the only time that she ever had to do that, I assume, or at least trying to navigate those cultural differences.
That's amazing, the effect it had on your father. Yeah. Although we'll learn later about some of the other procedures he turned to. We talked about the fact that it was your maternal grandparents who got out of Vietnam with you, but your father's parents were left behind in Saigon, although they did make it out too. And tell us that story.
Yeah, they were left behind for almost 5 years, and such a crazy story. So it was my paternal grandparents, and then my aunt, and then my father's older brother, who was a sergeant in the army. And so once the communists took over, everyone just sort of had to reallocate their work and possessions. And so my uncle and my grandfather decided that they would contract with the communist government and build them barges, and sort of, rebuild infrastructure. And so they built barges for the communists. And then on one of the barges, my uncle outfitted it with like a Caterpillar tractor engine instead of like a normal barge engine. And then after they got finished building the barges and got paid for them, my uncle and my grandparents and my youngest aunt stole one of the barges, the barge with the Caterpillar engine, and then nabbed and sailed away with falsified documents. They had bought fake Chinese passports, and they traveled with 10 gold bullions to bribe people along the way. and they sailed it across. They sailed it across the Gulf of Thailand to Malaysia, and and they got there, and it's unreal. Yeah,
and they ended up being able to join you in Carlisle.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. My dad just not too long ago shared with me these PDFs of. So my father's sponsor in America was helping. Once my dad got word that my grandparents had escaped, you know, my dad was trying to navigate sort of like U.S. Embassy and sort of, you know, State Department stuff. But my father's American sponsor, this incredible man named Bill Hook, was helping my father write letters through the State Department trying to locate, you know, my grandparents and his, you know, siblings, you know, in refugee camps, you know, these sort of ersatz, you know, basically homeless encampments in Malaysia. Yeah, but they finally found them and got them to Pennsylvania in 1979. Yeah.
Phuc Tran, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're back to talk more about his memoir, Sai, Gone, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. We mentioned the fact that a lot of beatings at home. Your teacher finally visited your parents, and it stopped. You talked about your father's rage and spring-loaded temper. And it's a funny sequence, then, him taking you and a friend to see Chariots of Fire, which, you know, darn it, for a kid your age, had no chariots and no fire. But, I mean, but there's a big effort that your father was making here, you tell us.
Yeah, it was. It was. And, you know, and it was amazing for me. You know, I've told that story a lot, and I've always told it as a sort of like a cultural disconnect story. You know, but in writing that story, I think I was really able to see, you know, that he really did try, you know, in his own sort of, you know, strange and wrongheaded way. And you know, part of it's just sort of like the disconnect and not understanding, you know, what the best movie in America really meant. Uh-huh. Do you want me to recount for your listeners in the shorthand of that?
Yeah.
Sure. So, you know, I was in fourth or fifth grade. I think it was fifth grade. And my father was, you know, he was reading the paper, you know, voraciously, just the abreast of sort of current events, as well as just the practices of English. And he read about, the Oscar for Best Picture going to Chariots of Fire, you know. And so he thought, well, this is the best picture in America, then this is really important. And so so he asked, me if I wanted to go to the movies, which he never asked me. And so I was elated, and I got to invite one friend, and so we all went to Chariots of Fire, and he had no idea what the movie was about. He just saw that it got an Oscar award for Best Picture. And so we went, and I promptly fell asleep, as did my friend. And then we woke up and the movie was over, because it was about it was the talkiest, most boring movie of all time, except that I'd spent all this time thinking that it was some sort of a sequel to Clash of the Titans, you know, which had also come out recently. So I was thinking Chariots of Fire, right? There's no way that title is hyperbolic.
So to this day, when you hear the Vangelis music, do you start to fall asleep?
Yes. I mean, it's pretty woozy anyway, right?
Da, 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 da.
Yeah. So terrible. I should never drive when that comes on.
the sense of humor that you and your brother both appear to have, and he's got a real sense of logic too. I mean, Lou is your younger brother, and his attachment to logic is great. I mean, when your parents would say, "Well, we're from Vietnam," what would he say?
Oh, and he would say, "But I'm not." You know, he would say, "I'm from Pennsylvania. I was born here." And I think kids are so they're so black and white. You know, and when people say, "Where are you from?" Like, he's thinking literally, right? I mean, kids are so literal. I see that in my own daughters. And I think it was just such a disconnect for him to constantly have people asking where he was born from Carlisle, you know, and yet, you know, to be sort of constantly peppered by that question of where are you from, you know, and always followed up by, "No, where are you really from?" You know, I think that really undermined his sense of place, as it did mine, I think. You know, and I think there's like a difference. I think I would always say that Carlisle is the place that I grew up, but I don't know if I could ever say that it's my hometown, because I think there are different associations with that I just don't have with a sense of place.
We have an email here from Jesse in Arcata, California, who says, please ask your guest to explore the notion of difference, in quotes, with us here in the United States through the lens of your lived experience and touching on the fear and violence narratives and actions that characterize ongoing notions of racial hierarchy. Thank you from Jesse in Arcata.
Wow. I think it's really important for us to have, you know, to really explore the idea of what it means to be an American. I try to do that in my memoir. I think it's important for us to sort of open up that notion or just blow it up completely about who fits in, you know, who has a seat at the table. And I think part of writing the book, that one of the things that motivated me was this idea, you know, people always saying, well, you don't look like a Latin teacher, you know, or, you know, I always think, what does that
look
mean?
Like? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I don't mean that in a confrontational way, but I think when people say that, I know exactly what they mean because I've ingested all of those assumptions and stereotypes about what it means to be a Latin teacher. Right. And unfortunately, I'm not a nun, or thankfully, I'm not a nun, and I'm not a, you know, bearded old guy wearing a tweed jacket. I just think those notions are really deep seated, and if they exist around things as banal as a Latin teacher, right? What is floating there in the ether around concepts of what does it mean to be American, and also, you know, who has a say in who is an American? I think those are important things for us to wrestle with.
Yeah, the whole concept of, well, this is our country. Well, who's the our and what's the country?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. We had a long talk recently with another author about being Asian in America, and she relayed the quote that sometimes gets flung at her. It's like, well, you guys are like the next white people.
Yeah, it is true, and I think that's fair to say. I think it's also incredibly dangerous, and it comes from a dangerous place. I think at least in some conversations, you know, the idea of being Asian American is adjacent to white, in that we are, you know, I mean, we're conveniently trotted out as sort of examples of the meritocracy working, you know, and yet, you know, we don't talk about how our entire immigration system was designed to only bring in doctors and lawyers and engineers from Asia, right? And then we hold them up and say, look, they're a total success story. And you're like, well, wait a second, you only let doctors, lawyers, and engineers in. So I think it's really tricky. And I think at any turn, I think it's really important for Asian Americans specifically, and Vietnamese Americans to, think about how, you know, the racist systems have helped them. I've certainly benefited from it. It's not a meritocracy at all, as far as I can tell.
How big a Vietnamese community was there in Carlisle? It sounds like there were a bunch of you there.
Pretty much everyone was related to me up until high school. So there was not a Vietnamese community in Carlisle at all. So it was our family. And then I think a handful of like Chinese families, you know, like second or third generation, but, you know, and then, you know, further flung afield, like in Harrisburg and Chambersburg and York, there were sort of small pockets of Vietnamese people. And then they started to find each other, right? But for some reason, my parents never chose to leave Carlisle. You know, I mean, you look at like Southern California or Virginia or Dallas, there's like huge enclaves of Vietnamese families. But for whatever reason, my parents just decided to stay put. And I'm not really sure why.
Huh. We talked about again the beatings in your household growing up, and that they did stop at some point. But you know, the other things that your father turned to as disciplinary measures, I wasn't quite sure whether to laugh or cry, honestly, at the stories of how your parents tried to scare you and Lou into behaving, and it did get fairly inventive. I'll give them that.
Yeah. I mean, there was necessity is the mother of invention, right? There was one episode where my parents, my dad kicked me out of the car one day because I was misbehaving in church. And so driving home, I think he just decided that, you know, he would just leave me by the side of the road, you know, and then they came back like, you know, maybe a half hour later and picked me up. And then, you know, one night they pretended to pack up all their bags and leave. You know, and I'm not sure. I don't know if that was better than getting beaten. I'm going to say it was, but I don't know. I mean, the damage is done. And
but yeah, you had details that make this funny, like realizing when you picked up the, you know, try to be helpful when they came home take their bags upstairs and wait a minute, they're really light, they're empty.
Yeah. I don't know, and I don't know. And at that moment, so when my parents pretended to leave, I thought they actually did leave, and then they came back, and then I, you know, sort of was like so relieved. And then when I picked up their suitcases, they were totally empty. And it was like this total bluff, you know. And at that moment, I was like, what is worse, like having your parents lie to you about abandoning you or having them beat you? It was really, yeah, it's, shout out to therapy. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. And of course, this is in the chapter named for a Carl Jung book, A Man and His Symbols. Give the connection there.
Yeah. That book in particular, or at least the idea of sort of Jungian archetypes, you know, was so, when I learned about it in high school, it really just kind of blew my mind, you know, and it's the idea that people and things can represent ideas that are greater or bigger than themselves. And when I learned about that, I was like, oh, it illuminated for me so profoundly my relationship with, you know, the white people in the town and veterans and all those things. I think that chapter opens up with sort of our many, I mean, just an example of our many encounters with Vietnam vets, you know, in Pennsylvania. And I mean, even to this day, you know, I meet vets, and I recognize that when Vietnam vets are talking to me, like, there's some piece of the interaction that is loaded in a way that I can't even begin to unpack.
Yeah. And have you ever,
because of that idea?
Have you ever broached that, you know, breached that boundary and gotten really into it with a Vietnam vet?
Not really. I mean, I think the timing is just not right. I think if it were longer and if I had a different relationship with them, I certainly would be happy to. But I think all I can say is, you know, I can listen to what they have to say. I mean, it's generally positive, and you know, they want to say, you know, talk about their experience. I mean, it's clear that they still have some processing that they need to do, and
sure.
I'm just there as a vector for that processing.
Yeah. I haven't asked about the chapter you call The Scarlet Letter, where you go into some fairly deep thoughts about Hester Prynne choosing to stay in her colony, and how did you draw a comparison with her and your own life?
Yeah, thanks. I'm so delighted that you were sort of struck by that chapter. I think it was one of the things that when I read The Scarlet Letter in high school, I guess I'm going to recap briefly the plot for your sisters who don't remember or have forgotten, but, you know, Hester is, you know, they live in colonial New England. She has an affair with a reverend, plot twist, spoiler alert there. And then she has a baby out of wedlock, and then the entire town shuns her, makes her live on the outskirts of the town, and then she has to wear a giant red letter A. And I thought to myself, why doesn't she move away? That seemed to be the easiest thing. But, you know, part of it also is this idea of the social contract, right? And where do we have meaning? You know, where can we live where we have meaning? And even if it's like a negative meaning, like we have some value in our society. And to me, that seems like part of the reason why Hester psychologically can't leave that town, because at least she still is there and has value and people still know her, right? And it's part of that social contract.
Hmm. Part of a society that she understands.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I haven't asked about the punk rock part of your life very much yet. Who was your gateway group?
Right. I would say, you know, I heard that there was a band from Southern California called Agent Orange. I heard them very early on. I would say maybe Agent Orange and then The Clash and the Sex Pistols. When I heard punk rock in probably 86, 87, it was probably like, you know, 10 years past its, you know, sort of expiration date, but it still sounded so relevant to me and so powerful. I think as a young kid, well, the first time you hear music that's really angry, and it's not the Beatles and it's not Billy Joel or, you know, Madonna, you're like, what is this?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a bit of a difference. But so now the tough question for any fan of The Clash, was Train in Vain a sellout?
No, I love, good for you. I don't think so at all. I think I actually think it was the most punk thing they could do was to be authentic to themselves, and to really blow up that blueprint of that, you know, which is, you know, it ends up being so claustrophobic, right, and so narrow about what is punk rock. No, I think Train in Vain is incredible. You know, I think it's the most punk thing they could do is to be unpunk. Yeah.
We all remarked upon it at the time it came out that on the LP, because of course it was still out on vinyl at that time, that it was not listed as the track listing.
Yeah. It was a love song, right? It's like this strange, like Motown, you know, heartbreak song. It's just amazing. Yeah, pretty
close. So do you still enjoy the music, or have you moved on to other tastes in music?
I do. I think it's for me, it's nostalgia driven. You know, I think like my own current, you know, listening habits, are much more eclectic now. You know, I think one of the best things, I think following the model of the Clash, I think, very explicitly, you know, I think once the Clash decided that, you know, being sort of genre specific and being burdened by, being sort of punk fundamentalist was really narrow, you know, and very restricting. You know, I think once I left high school, you know, I started listening to like hip hop and like R&B, and you know, like imagine like being like a 20-year-old and discovering Motown for the first time. Uh-huh. I thought I'd found like, you know, El Dorado. I was like, what is this? Who's Marvin Gaye? You know, like, this is amazing. Yeah, so I think now I just listen to whatever is good, you know, and I think, you know, I was comparing it to like being a vegan for a long time and then all of a sudden going to like an all-you-can-eat buffet and being like, wait, I can eat all of this? You know, like, it's pretty incredible.
Oh, that's a great sense of discovery and wonder at the world around you still.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. I love it. I mean, there's so many books I haven't read, and songs I haven't discovered, and it's pretty rich.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there still. One final question here, and I'm still trying to figure out if you're a Latin teacher who does tattoos on the side, or are you a tattoo artist who teaches Latin on the side?
Yeah, I think it depends on who you ask. You know, all my Latin students would say, you know, that I do the other thing on the side, and then all my tattooer friends would say I teach Latin on the side. Uh-huh. You know, I think at every step of the way, I think I just try to, you know, be authentic and true to who I am and break the binary. It's a false choice.
Yeah. It's really a rich journey through life. The book is called Cy Gon, that's Cy, Gon, A Misfit's Memoir of Great Books, Punk Rock, and the Fight to Fit In by Phuc Tran. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey.
Take care. And that will do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. You're not hearing As It Was today because, we're still working with canned episodes and there's not one ready for today. That's a story on As It Was. Our producers are John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care of yourself. Have a great day.